Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor is the new podcast, and if you haven't heard it yet, it is an incredibly fun way to get your health information from somebody that you can trust. And that would be our next guest. I'm Lee Rayburn, and joining us this hour is Dr. Zorba Pastor, online at drzorba.org, and updating his podcast regularly with his co-host, Carl Christensen. It's Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor, and you find it on his website. But if you have a question for Zorba this hour, he's got an answer for you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can always send us an email as well, talk@wpr.org. And Zorba, welcome back to the show as always.
For this. I mean, really, what a great introduction. Now I can leave. I'll just walk out.
Well, I have enjoyed your podcast immensely. I have learned a lot from it, like how deadly the roads get when new music gets released.
Yeah.
That was fascinating to me, but it made a ton of sense at the same time.
Right, right. Because all of a sudden people are fiddling with it, you know, what's going on. Look at the new cars. I got a new car.
And touchscreen display.
It's got all this stuff around it. And, you know, you got to look over there and all of a sudden you crash. And
distracted driving.
That's a big issue. That's right. You never think about that.
I do now. And I look at like big music releases. Yeah. I'm like, I don't think I'll be biking today.
No, actually, that's not a bad idea. Do you have a radio on your bike when you bike?
I do not use headphones when I'm biking because I want to have.
Right.
My ears are kind of my thing, so I want to be able to hear everything around me.
Well, and the reality is that's critical because otherwise you can't hear the stuff around you when you're on a bike. You're out in the open.
I had a bike versus car a couple years ago, and I was on the wrong side of that, just scraped up, but it was a scary. You know, sharing the road with cars when you're a biker, it's scary. Sharing the road with bikers when you're a car, it can be frustrating. So I understand both sides.
But the car wins.
Every time. Zorba.
100% of the time, the bike comes out.
So we have been talking about dental care earlier, and I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the connection between our mouth, our gums, and our heart, because I don't think people necessarily make that connection, but it's real.
Absolutely real. There's good data that shows that keeping your teeth well, you know, keeping your teeth and your gums in good shape makes a major difference in heart disease, heart attacks, and stroke.
Why?
And so the importance of flossing, for instance, not just brushing, but flossing, gets rid of bacteria that are in your mouth that we think sort of form, if you will, a gumming solution that affects inflammation, and that inflammation in your mouth leads to inflammation in your coronary arteries. So part of taking care of your heart is not just cholesterol drugs, exercising, eating the Mediterranean diet, but it's also taking care of your teeth. And people don't realize that. They don't realize that importance, as well as the fact that if you don't have all your teeth, you often lose a lot of nutrition.
Oh.
You can't chew fruits and vegetables. You can't chew them as much. Your teeth aren't working. So the reality is, because if you have just few teeth, you end up eating soft foods. Soft foods are often ultra-processed, very much so, or they're carbohydrates. Can't eat anything that is too thick. And so there are big issues. Taking care of your teeth is important to taking care of your entire body.
You struck upon a word that has come up in just about all of our healthcare interviews over the first 2 months of my time here, and that is inflammation. It has come up when we've talked about Alzheimer's and dementia. It's come up with gum disease, cardiovascular disease. That inflammation seems to be at the core, or at least connected to many of our health maladies.
That right now is the present thought. So I was talking to a cardiologist recently about atrial fibrillation. Become more and more common as you get older. It becomes more and more common. And what are the risk factors for that? Turns out one of the major risk factors, besides having previous cardiac disease, is obesity. I said, well, why is that? She said, well, the theory is that when you're overweight, you actually have more inflammation in your body, and that leads to atrial fibrillation. I said, but how do we measure it? And she said, we don't have any good tools, which is right. We have something called a SED rate, minimal tool. It's been around for 125 years, nothing more than that. Something called C-reactive protein, been around for maybe 95 years. And then we may have some minimal tools, but we think it's there, but we don't understand how to measure it. In other words, the measurements we have right now are very crude.
Do we know how to control inflammation?
No. Well, we know how to control it by eating right, exercising, you know, essentially taking care of your body. And we know one of the things is flossing. Brushing your teeth and flossing. That was a setup question.
Well, I find it interesting that inflammation has been central to many of these health discussions we've had on this show.
Right.
And so is the solution for many of the health problems that we've discussed on the on this show. Exercise, healthy lifestyle, eating right, limiting the bad things like alcohol and smoking.
Right.
And if you do that, you can live a healthier life, but maybe there is a connection there with inflammation that we just haven't been able to measure yet.
Well, there is. So we've got a number of drugs that lower cholesterol.
Oh, yeah.
The drugs we use are statins. It's not just they lower cholesterol. They lower inflammation in the coronary arteries. And that actually has been shown. So they don't just reduce cholesterol, because there are drugs that reduce cholesterol like niacin, which you take it in a large enough dose, it reduces it. But it does not prevent heart attacks and strokes like statins, because they have a secondary way of actually affecting the coronary arteries. And an inflamed artery is more likely to get a plaque on it, cholesterol plaque, and that's more likely to break off and then cause a heart attack or a stroke. So we know that from a statin point of view, that it's two factors that work on that drug, and that's why those drugs are the most important drugs to take if you have coronary artery disease or, you know, your tendency to get that.
One of the big drugs that I'm hearing the most about right now are the GLP-1 drugs, the weight loss drugs.
Right.
And I would be very interested in your take on these and how useful they can be, how prevalent they've become so quickly, and whether or not there could be some side effects that we have yet to consider.
Well, I think they're great drugs, by the way.
Okay.
And we've been using them for 20 years.
Really?
But the first ones, Victoza and the one before Victoza, which I can't remember the generic name, we used it in diabetes. But it was a short-acting drug. It had minimal effect on appetite. People might lose 5 pounds or 10 pounds. And so they kept on actually looking for drugs that were more effective for diabetes and more long-acting. And then those drugs, the GLP-1 drugs that they have now, also have changed things. But the first GLPs have been around 20 years ago, almost no weight loss. So what do? They increase insulin coming out of your pancreas. That's very good. They decrease something called glucagon. Now, glucagon is stored in the liver, and what it does is when we need extra blood sugar, it sends it out into the body. So it decreases the sugar storage in the liver. They reduce gastric emptying, so that's where the GI complaints come in. So your stomach doesn't empty as quickly, and you feel more food. The next thing they do, they affect something in within the brain, hypothalamus, maybe the amygdala, where this food noise that people talk about, they decrease the dopamine response when you get foods that really pipe it up, you know, high fat, high sweet, get rid of the dopamine response.
I love those foods.
So
that's my dopamine talking, right. I think.
Yes, but you don't have a weight problem, so you control it. You're able to control it.
It controls me sometimes, Zorba.
But they are very good drugs, and they work well for diabetes. Side effects, hair loss in some people.
Huh.
That's a known side effect that comes with it. The GI side effects happen, but if you increase it slowly, that can usually be stopped. And not everyone has a significant weight loss. It's not everybody. Not everybody on it loses 20, 30, 40, 50 pounds. Many people may lose 5 or 10. And so it leads to disappointment, and that can be an issue.
Is there a deciding factor on why people lose less and some lose more?
I haven't read anything about it.
Huh.
We just know some do not lose as much. I haven't read any article. There may be some, but from what I've read, nothing has come up that really stands scientific scrutiny. But yes, and the drugs are good for other things, like addiction. It's been used now for alcoholism. It's used
GLP-1s also. GLP-1s for alcoholism.
It may reduce substance use disorder. Alcohol, the cravings of alcohol may be reduced. The dopamine response when you get drunk.
Okay.
The dopamine response when you use an injectable drug. The dopamine response when you use oxycodone and hydrocodone. So there's lots of research looking at GLP drugs as a useful adjunct, something else that you can use while while you're trying to handle the substance use disorder that is ravaging the country.
Dr. Zorba Pastor joining us, his new podcast, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. Make sure you check it out, drzorba.org. Was talking about the measles outbreak we're seeing in southwest Wisconsin, and it just keeps growing according
it's
to the
astounding.
News over the weekend.
So guess how many measles cases there were in the U.S. in, I think it was 1998 or the year 2000? 20.
Oh.
And it was considered to be eliminated. 20 cases. And now in Wisconsin, we have more cases than we had a year ago or a year and a half ago. And remember, you get the rash. Are you going to go to the doctor? No, your doctor is going to say to stay home.
Uh-huh.
And if you look it up, you know, you Google it and you see, well, I bet they have measles. You're not necessarily going to tell anyone because you might be embarrassed. So you've got to take those numbers. And I think they're like 2,000 in Wisconsin right now.
So we're saying we're underreporting measles.
Totally. Oh. You've got to double it or triple it,
oh.
Of course. So first of all, if you want to know if you have measles, before you get the rash, there's a spot that appears in the buccal mucosa. That is, open up your mouth, take your finger, open your gum on the side. Here,
uh-huh.
On the side. You're doing it right on the side.
Uh-huh.
Pull it to your right ear.
I got it.
On the right ear, you look good. On the right ear or left ear, you will see a spot. It's called Koplik spot. It is what we call pathognomonic for measles. If it's there, you have measles. No other disease or rash does that. So you look in the mouth, you see a spot there on the right over there. It's not on the gum of the teeth. It's on the mucosa, the outside part. It means you have measles. But then you see the rash. It starts a day or two before the rash and stays there during part of that rash. And measles is the number one, probably number one most contagious viral infection we have. We have a numbering system. COVID was like 2 or 3 if you're in a room.
Mm-hmm.
Influenza is like 4 or 5. Measles is 18 or 19. If you leave the room,
whoa,
30 minutes later, somebody can come in the room and contract measles.
So it's incredibly contagious, but uh-huh. It's also incredibly preventable.
Totally. So Wisconsin, you know, we have, we think that we have good public service stuff. You know, we get our kids immunized for measles, except for like outbreaks over there. If you look at the number of children with MMR vaccine in Wisconsin over the last, I think it's 5 or 10 years, we are number 49 out of 50.
Whoa.
Number 1 and 2 are West Virginia and Mississippi. And we are 49 out of 50.
Wait, in terms of how many children
uh-huh.
have the MM?
Uh-huh. How many children have been fully vaccinated? West Virginia and Mississippi lead the pack, and we're number 49.
I suppose I'm surprised by this.
Aren't you?
I thought we would be.
There's a very good reason. So in Mississippi and West Virginia, years ago, they said, we have too many kids who are not getting immunized because the parents say they have personal exemption. So what they did, they decided to change the rules. You can have personal exemption after you go in and talk to your doctor or a clinician, healthcare provider, and then you can do it, but you can't do it willy-nilly on your own. Wisconsin allows personal exemption automatically. You just sign it.
Without any medical guidance.
No medical guidance. And importantly, your kid's getting ready to go to school. That's what we're talking about. And you didn't get all the immunizations you should get. And you want your kid to go to school. And you're going to school and they give you a form. And you go, are they fully immunized? And you can say personal exemption. And then your kid can go to school even though they're not fully immunized. They don't say you've got to discuss it with your doctor. Now, I do not know why Mississippi and West Virginia is leading the pack, and we are number 49. But that is clearly part of the case.
You talked about this in your latest podcast, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. There was an executive order from the White House that would break up the, what is it called, MMR
correct.
Vaccine into 3 separate
mm-hmm.
vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
So mumps, measles, mm-hmm. and rubella would mm-hmm. need 3 separate injections.
Right.
Is there a medical reason for this? Would it benefit people?
Of course not. There is no, it's rubbish. I call it rubbish. So first of all, when the vaccines first came out, they were independent. There was a measles, there was a rubella.
This is the way it used to be.
Yeah, it was. And then And people said, we want to get these vaccines together, and including chickenpox if we can, which came out a number of years, like 10 or 20 years later. And so the drug companies got together, and Merck, I think, was one of them, and they made a 3-in-1 vaccine. And they said, great, we don't have to bring our kid in 3 times. We don't have to pay for a copay 3 times. I don't have to take off from work 3 times. So even though the feds have said, that's what we want you to do, it's really controlled by the state in many ways, the drug companies are not going to invest the money. First of all, it would take 5 to 7 years at the soonest to prove it's safe and effective. In other words, it would take a long time. Mm-hmm. Then they'd have to ramp it up. Then they have to develop, you know, production facilities are going to do it. And then, of course, by the time they even did all that, people are going to want to say, wait a minute, I want the 3-in-1. So it's going to say, as we say, fall on deaf ears.
When the president made this announcement, mm-hmm. according to the Morning Edition story from NPR, he justified it by citing autism connection, mm-hmm. or at least a rise in vaccines and a rise in autism, alluding to the connection there. Yeah. Is there a medical case to be made for any connection between the two?
No. And so part of the rise for autism is we have changed the criteria for autism. So when autism was first started, if you look at the DSM, which are the psychiatric criteria, they called it infantile schizophrenia.
Oh.
That's what they called it. And they didn't develop the word autism, you know, until Asperger's, until, like, I don't know, maybe 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And then they kept on changing the criteria. So a lot of kids, more and more kids are being diagnosed as autistic. In fact, they may be on, quote, on the spectrum. But you can't take a child who's minimally on the spectrum and compare them to a child that is severely burdened with autism. They're totally different things. So there is no scientific evidence that immunizations cause autism. There's just rubbish going out there. And part of that is really because RFK was very much interested in this. And he sued a lot of companies and made, I don't know, somewhere between $2 and $10 million from the lawsuits. So I think he has a parochial investment in continuing that, or he is just a member of the anti-immunization cult. And I usually don't discuss those things in medicine, but I am a person of science. And when science is attacked, it's like a mother bear with her cubs. I'm going to attack back. And there's no scientific evidence for it. But people are now worried. Yeah. And that's where they have to carry on a discussion with their healthcare provider who they trust.
There is a vaccine hesitancy. And
of course,
you know, if it's, I just wonder where it comes from and whether or not there is a medical explanation for vaccine hesitancy or if it's more of a social issue.
I think it's a social thing. I mean, you know, it's society has changed. So we have to take, when I discuss this with patients, and I still work, I say, let's take COVID and influenza out of this right now. And let's look at the risky vaccines. So there's something called rotavirus that is taken off the list by the government. Well, rotavirus, when I was in medical school, they didn't know what infantile diarrhea was from. And when I was there back in the 70s, Cook County Hospital had wards of kids, especially under the year of one, with rampant diarrhea from a viral infection they didn't know. Then they finally identified rotavirus. Then they actually got a wonderful vaccine, which you take in your mouth. You don't even get a shot.
Hmm.
And the number of cases dropped generally from 70,000 to 80,000 hospitalizations a year to 7,000.
Wow.
It's dropped by 90%. So if you want to protect your child against this virus that's all around in the environment, then you want to give this vaccine. So I tell people, let's separate it out. There's certain vaccines that I think are important, and you can do those, you know, I think MMR and I think rotavirus, and then we'll talk about the other ones. I think all or nothing is not going to work with people who are, you know, hesitant about vaccines.
Well, let's talk about the other ones, because we've got flu and COVID vaccines on the way for fall, and would Dr. Zorba Pastor get a flu and COVID vaccine this year?
Oh, totally.
Okay.
So let's talk about COVID. A friend of mine and I mean, I'm an old guy. I'm 79. So we looked it up. 79 years of age. If I get COVID, I'm fully immunized. Should I take Paxlovid? Okay, that's the question. So the initial data said, yeah, Paxlovid.
Which is what you take after you get COVID,
yeah.
Right?
So, yeah, afterwards. I don't get the vaccine. I get COVID. Paxlovid reduces the death rate by 50%. Sounds good, right? It goes from 1% to 0.5%. In the immunized, if I get it. So in other words, that really is not very much at all. So you've got to look at the numbers and the percentage to decide that.
Look at the science, is what you're saying. Look at the collected data.
Right. That's exactly right. Now, influenza is special. It rotates around the world, and it mutates as it rotates. So we use the information from Australia to then make our vaccine that's coming here, and we take we do our best guess, and then when it comes here, it may mutate. It may not have the Aussie accent.
It probably mutates, right? I mean, it's got to make a long trek. This is an constantly changing virus.
That's right. It does. It mutates through humans.
Yeah.
I mean, not just on its own. Goes into a human. May the best flu virus win, and the best ones come out on top.
And goes to the next person.
Oh,
but
God.
So how
it's
effective
competition.
Are they? You just talked about this in one of your most recent podcasts, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor, the mRNA vaccine for flus, like we have it for COVID.
Right.
This
right.
is now going to be available for flus?
That's right. And the mRNA vaccine, which I think may be available this year, I'm not exactly sure, but I think so. It's a new type of vaccine that we can do. Most importantly, we can change it quickly. That's part of the issue. In other words, when the flu bug arrives, if they say it's going to be a bad year, that means that this vaccine that's being developed is not exactly the right one. They can go in and massively produce lots of new vaccine much quicker than the old analog way of producing vaccines.
So as opposed to trying to match the flu vaccine to flus from Australia, we find what the flu bug is when it arrives here in the States and are able to produce a vaccine much quicker through mRNA.
Something of that nature. That's it. Or a combination of both. Australia says, hey, these are the things that I think are most likely. They get set up. And then there may be a way of which say, well, it looks like, because it's coming across the globe, looks like it's going to be changed this. They can change how they do it. This is a major technological breakthrough in how quickly vaccines can be produced and, if you will, the efficacy of vaccines.
Do you expect to be able to get this vaccine this fall? Will you take a flu vaccine, even if it is a questionable effectiveness?
Oh, yes, yes. Even though I've had flu vaccine, which I've had since medical school, I still have got influenza three times. I mean,
Times since the 70s?
I'm an old guy.
Yeah, I was going to say three times since the 70s sounds like pretty good.
Yeah, but I forgot the vaccine because some years it doesn't work. That
right?
Yeah, I think it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
the
it's 70s, not all or none.
That's, the disco was a long time ago, Zorba.
That's exactly right. I'm not complaining. That's right. Stop complaining. You got it three times over 50 years.
So you will get the flu vaccine, even if there is a slight chance you might get the flu because it doesn't match.
Oh, yeah. No doubt about it. And I generally get my vaccine in about mid-October. Even though it's around now, I want to make sure it's still working well during the height of the flu season, especially if it's later.
How long does it last?
It depends on the year and stuff. I mean, it can last for 6 months, 4 months, or 6 months. You can get a second vaccine, which may be what the mRNA is going to be. Like, we've got a newer vaccine, you get a second shot. I don't know how it's going to work out. But yeah, it doesn't necessarily
You want to
last
get through March,
season.
I would think, because March can be a tough one.
March Madness.
In Wisconsin.
March Madness.
Yeah, well, there's an excuse for you if you want to stay home and watch basketball for a few weeks. But it's not the excuse you want, because that can be... Well, it can.
That's
flu
right.
can be deadly.
That's right. And March is a difficult month. You know, we're coming out of it. Yeah. It's icy. It's rainy. It's weather. And there's a lot of flu that goes around in March.
Dr. Zorba Pastor, our guest. I've monopolized him enough, so let me invite you to the conversation. I'm sorry. I've just had too much fun with him. 1-800-642-1234 to join Dr. Zorba Pastor. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our conversation continues with The Good Doctor next. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. It's Your Turn with our guest, Dr. Zorba Pastor. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you can find more Zorba anytime on his new podcast, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor, along with his co-host, who have a lot of fun with health, Carl Christensen, and online at drzorba.org. And the line to our studio right now is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Also, I have a few emails to get to, and you can send one of those to talk at wpr.org. And we'll start with Ann in Madison. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I'm 82, and I'm wondering if, of course, back when we were kids, we got all the childhood vaccines. But I'm wondering now, with measles going around, is it something that seniors should be getting another shot at this time?
Not, that is not recommended by the CDC. So, you know, if you were young, you know, you remember, I mean, you most likely, 99% chance, 99%, that you had measles and you had chickenpox, you know, which is varicella. A lot of people did not get mumps. That was not the mumps virus, not as much. And then many people got, quote, the German measles. I have no idea where that came from. It's rubella. And that still, you know, you most likely had all of those. So the answer is recommendations not to get it. I'm not going to get it, you know. And I do remember some of those diseases. I remember my mother thought when I had measles that I would go blind. And that was because some kids got meningitis.
Oh, that's scary.
So I was in Chicago in the summer in a dark room without a TV. And I never read. So it was like the worst summer ever. It was boredom. And she brought me up boiled beef because she heard that was good to give the measles.
I'm so sorry.
Boiled beef.
You're in a sensory deprivation tank.
Sensory deposition eating boiled beef in my room for like 10 days. She was trying to do a good job.
So don't get the mumps, kids, because you don't want to end up like Zorba.
Boiled beef. That's right.
But these vaccines, they're supposed to be for life, right?
The vaccines are for life right now.
So if you've had them before.
Unless you have an autoimmune response, you know, autoimmune disease, unless you're on certain drugs like prednisone, if you're on that chronically, but they can do a titer. They can do a blood test to see if you need it. Or your doctor may just say, let's just vaccinate you with MMR. Because there's certain medical problems that would then, that could reduce your ability to fight it. So for instance, chickenpox, you know, if you drop your, essentially, if you don't have as much, you know, antiviral load on there, you're not as immunized from either the shot or rather for the disease when you had it, that becomes shingles.
Right.
So you've got to have chickenpox in order to get that. And there's some that say you should get the shingles vaccine because it'll, you know, the chickenpox vaccine because it will prevent shingles.
I don't remember the chickenpox vaccine when I was a kid. I think that came after the chickenpox parties that would erupt.
Did you go to a chickenpox party?
I got the chickenpox. But I did get the shingles vaccine because the stories about shingles are like horror 100%. Stories that could be, you know.
Right.
I don't, the pain that people talk about is not something I want to.
Terrible pain. For some people, it lasts for life. That's about 5 or 10%. Some it lasts for 6 months or longer. And then the new shingles vaccine, the one that we use now, Shingrix by GSK. It's a two vaccine. The old one, Merck, was okay, but not as good as this one. And the other interesting thing is there seems to be a drop in dementia for people who get the shingles vaccine. And we don't know why, but right now the data is really enticing that there's something there. And if you go and search for it, it's a very interesting thing. It's not kablooey. There's some signals that there may be something in the vaccination or getting rid of any viral, you know, any virus that's still there for you, that maybe that virus is partially responsible for dementia.
Ann, I'm so glad you asked. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Mike in Madison next. Hi, Mike.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about the law of unintended consequences with the doctor.
Sure.
Back in 2013, when they released this DSM-5, they lumped in all of Asperger's into one category, called it autism. And it basically just opened up the door for somebody like Kennedy to say, aha,
right.
It's on the rise.
Right.
Why not release DSM-6 and pull it back out and say, no, Asperger's is not autism, because now you've just added another 100,000 or a million kids a year into this category.
Right. Well, you're 100% correct.
Now, the DSM is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual,
used by psychiatry, developed somewhere.
And it has been in the past historically horribly wrong in some cases.
Oh, yes. Oh, sure.
Like with homosexuality.
It called it a disease for many years. But this then allows people who are, quote, on the spectrum to then have certain needs that have to be met within, for instance, the school system. Some of them truly need it. That's a big issue. Do they need extra care in the school system? And do they have other ways of treating it? But you're right. Once they took Asperger's and put everything in it, that's where, quote, autism came from. And that's where that's when the cult started.
The anti-vaccination
cult. I call it a cult.
Okay. Vaccine hesitancy because...
Well, I think that's different. I think 10% of the population will always be against vaccines. But I think that was pretty much the same case. If you look at the data, by the way, of mothers who bring their kids to school and you question them, whether they're red or blue or pink or yellow, no matter what their political persuasion, do you want all of the kids in your child's class in kindergarten to be vaccinated? Before Trump, before this and RFK, 88% said yes, we want all the kids to be vaccinated. After all of this stuff that came out, it dropped to 87%.
All right, then.
In other words,
you're talking
mothers,
about Junior, by the way. I want to delineate between
the original RFK and Junior. So it turns out that mothers asked about vaccines are not necessarily paying all the attention to politics because they have small children at home.
They've got more important things to pay attention to.
That's right. They're changing diapers and getting school lunches together, and they want their kids safe.
And they all want the very best for their kids.
Absolutely.
It's just we seem to be operating under different data sets more and more often.
Absolutely. I mean, so you have areas, of course, in the country which are non-vaccinated areas, like in the state of Wisconsin. But on the whole, fathers may be a little different, but mothers have said, no, I want my kids vaccinated, everyone in the class. And it's only dropped 1%. So they have failed in their advertising campaign.
Mike, I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you for helping explain things. Christina in Glenwood City, you're next. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I am an active 68-year-old. I weigh about 100 pounds. I eat the Mediterranean diet. Take responsibility for my health. So what I'd like to do, first of all, is share my most recent vaccine history with the personal effects and then ask what you would recommend.
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
I had the COVID vaccine, Moderna. I had it a total of 3 times. The first 2 times, no effects whatsoever. The third time, I got brain fog that lasted months. Mm-hmm. It was reported and all of that. So I haven't had the COVID vaccine in a couple of years.
Sure. And I wouldn't get it.
Okay.
I wouldn't get it.
Thank you.
If it were me, you were my patient, I would say, forget it. You know, get immunized. If you're worried in public, wear a mask or anything like that, but forget it.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And then I haven't had a flu shot in probably over 20 years, and I never get the flu.
Mm-hmm.
I have had RSV probably a couple of years ago.
Sure.
And
5,000 adults die of that every year.
Okay. And then I have never had a pneumonia shot.
I'm sorry, that number was 15,000 adults and children die of RSV virus every year.
Okay. Yes, it was. It was a tough one to get through.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never had a pneumonia vaccine, and in June I had what the doctor thought was bronchitis.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't take anything for it. They gave me a prescription for an inhaler, which I didn't fill.
Yeah.
And
so,
I just got through it.
So what's your question?
I'm wondering what vaccines you would recommend for somebody like me with that shared history.
Okay. So one question, you're 100 pounds. How tall are you?
I'm 5'1" and a half.
5'1" and a half. Okay, so I want to make sure you're not what we call cachectic, where you're really, really, really too thin. So I am pro-vaccines. So let me start that out. I get all the vaccines. The pneumonia doesn't take care of all forms of pneumonia, but certain ones that are more likely to kill you, you get the pneumonia vaccine. Some people need one vaccine, some need two. You have to talk to your clinician if you decide. Depends on the year of your age. There's certain numbers that you have to look at for that. I get a flu vaccine every year. As I said, RSV kills 15,000. Influenza kills about 35 to 50,000.
But Christina hasn't gotten the flu in like forever.
That's right. That's
does
right.
That
That's
would
right.
that be well, a reason not to get the vaccine?
Well, let me ask you a question. When was the last time you got into a car accident?
Me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Well, you. I guess it's been years.
Okay, years. I mean a serious one. I don't mean a fender bender, a serious one. So it's you can't remember when you got into a bad car accident, right? So when you get into your car, do you wear seatbelts or not?
Yes.
Then it's your choice. That's what vaccines are. You've got to think of it that way. You may not have suffered from influenza or died.
She can't be immune from influenza, could she?
Well, it changes every year. So you might not have a bad reaction to influenza. It might seem like, I mean, a lot of people have it and it's kind of a little cold. Doesn't feel like very much. And other people get very sick. The older you are, the more likely you are to have a serious effect from a viral infection because you are old, and therefore your immune system is not as good because you're no longer young. You know, when you look in the mirror, you sag, right? I sag, you sag, everyone sags at 80, and I'm 79.
You don't have to point it out.
Your immune system also sags. So your choice, buckle up, and then you decide whether or not you want to buckle up with the vaccine. That's the way to look at it.
Christina, thank you very much for the call, and certainly something to think about. Even with a healthy lifestyle, you're still going to wear your seatbelt.
Because we sag as we get older.
I don't think I'll forget that analogy. Joe and Economowoc, you're next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. It's so great to hear the doctor on the radio again.
Thank you.
I'm sure I speak for many that we miss you, and we miss your laugh and years ago with Tom Clark, it was just a gas.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for, thanks for coming back on, and thanks for having the courage to stand up to this crazy administration. And a lot of people don't want to really speak out in any regard. I'm sure you're going to get a little bit of flack somewhere.
Of course,
but
of course.
Stand up for science.
My wife Penny gave me flack all the time, so I can take flack from other people. her slings and arrows were the ones that hurt. I mean, forget about other people. You can just close your ears or smile.
Well, thanks for having the courage to either speak out about this, because this is ridiculous. I don't think enough people are debunking all the conspiracy stuff, not just the medical, but. You know, there's enough medical that you could probably do a session of your podcast just on debunking.
That's
right. You know, a lot of times professionals don't want to get into the nitty gritty details. And I don't find a lot of debunking specialists that really take it line by line, because for one, they never end with their conspiracies. You debunk one, they come up with another answer and another answer.
Well, you bring up interesting things about doctors. They don't want to engage in conversations like that. So on the whole, they're wusses.
Oh, I just thought they were above the fray.
Sorry.
They don't want to enter into what has become a very divisive and caustic culture.
The fray. They just are saying, next.
No, I don't want to believe that. Science shouldn't be political. Science is
political,
a method of understanding.
And it was not political until pretty much recently, but it's gone in and out of politics. When Jenner first came out with immunizations for smallpox from cowpox, it wasn't embraced by everyone, but that was in the 1780s.
We've come a long way
since
then.
Well, now we have the internet.
Well, that's true, where anybody could say anything. Joe, your point is well taken. And by the way, you can hear Dr. Zorba Pastor anytime on Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. Just go to drzorba.com .org and check it out. And he does do some debunking on that. Go ahead.
I did have a main question if you got another second.
Please.
It was my sister-in-law's in her 70s, and we were concerned with all this measles talk. Well, can people even remember if they had a measles shot when they were a kid or whatever? Maybe she didn't. So the doctor did offer a blood test, and we got it, and it did show that she still has whatever you call it, like immunity or whatever.
Correct.
Against
Correct.
It. So would you recommend that in general if you were in practice right now, just telling everyone to get this blood test?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't tell everyone to get the blood test, because if you were below a certain age, the measles vaccine came out, I think, in 59, but you needed a booster. It wasn't discovered that you needed one early on and then a booster at the age of 5 till like 5 years later. So anyone who received the vaccine, they, you know, in earlier, before 1960, you have to look at the CDC website, but they have some recommendations on whether or not you should get a titer, but not for everyone, no. Most of us had measles. I mean, it spreads like wildfire.
Right.
And so even though you don't know, but if you have other serious medical problems, then they may want to do a titer. But I don't recommend everyone go out and get a titer. No, not
at
all.
If I'm not mistaken, Wisconsin has an immunization registry where you may be able to check to see if there is some record of your
vaccines. But not before 1960, you know.
That would make
sense.
We
were just using cuneiform tablets, and we didn't hardly knew
had
how
an
to
abacus
write them.
In there.
that's right.
It was long before the disco era 70s
that's right.
of Dr.
Long before,
Zorba.
That's right. That's right. Before the Beatles, no. No.
Anything pre-Beatles, you're going to want to make sure, if you
probably,
can't remember.
You know what? That's probably right. Anything pre-Beatles, that is a good moniker as actually where it is. You might have had the vaccine without the booster, right? Thank you.
Joe, thank you for calling. John in Fitchburg is evidently pre-Beatles. His circle of septuagenarian friends have recently had several episodes of vertigo. Mm-hmm. He wants to know if vertigo is age-related and what are the best ways to resolve it.
Well, vertigo is present. A lot of people get vertigo, but as you get older, it seems to be more common. And many causes of vertigo are called benign positional vertigo, which means that there's nothing wrong with your middle ear. You don't need it, and antihistamines are not generally going to work. And so the best treatment, which is done by a physical therapist, but you can do at home through going to a YouTube video, is called Epley's Maneuver, which I think is spelled E-P-P-L-Y-S, something like that. I always misspell it, but if you put it in Google, it'll spell it correctly.
Epley's Maneuver.
That's right. And so look at Epley's Maneuver. There are a couple of good cartoons that start up with that and other ways of doing it. And you can do it at home. And the theory, which really seems to hold up with a lot of it, is you have something like a calcium, a little calcium chip that goes out of place in the semicircular canals. Your vertical, we have three little canals inside our ear, by our ear, that tell us what position we're in. When we're kids, we like to spin around and get those canals going. As adults, we never like it at all. And you remember that?
Yeah.
Don't you remember? Twirl around as fast as
you
could.
Oh, yeah, that was just fun for some reason back in the day.
When was the last time you did it?
Before the Beatles.
Before the Beatles. So the Epley's Maneuver tries to move that little chunk of calcium, tiny, tiny chunk, out of the wrong canal back into the right canal. And it's very effective in many people. Once again, PT does it. They do a great job. Sometimes one visit for PT and then you can do it at home. But I tell a lot of people to do it. Go to YouTube video and look at it and just spell it right. And if you put it on Google, you will spell it right.
Epley's Maneuver,
right.
And they can help with that. It's E-P-L-E-Y,
oh, God,
according to our producer,
P-C.
Joel.
That's you know,
all right. You'll
it's
get
amazing
there.
I got this far with this
Google
little
knows.
Dyslexia.
Google. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I reverse letters sometimes. But so I went into science.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't happen with numbers. With me, I mean, a 5 looks like a 5.
Yeah.
Doesn't look like anything else.
Wow. So. I'm just, you know, your depth of knowledge, your breadth of knowledge, and the way you deliver
thanks.
It. I mean, you've, and
you.
Your bedside manner.
Thanks.
I mean, you're the doctor I want to have, Zorba.
Thank you.
And everybody else, too. So let's get back. This isn't about me. This is about Zorba. Paul in Princeton, you're next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how you doing? I was calling about your comments about statin drugs. I feel that you're misleading people a little bit on statin drugs.
Go ahead.
What's your argument against statins?
Well, if you look at the data,
Where are you looking at the data? So where is your data coming from?
It's coming from many different sources.
Such as
if
what?
You let me finish. Give me an example.
Let me
finish. 1 in 250 people are affected negatively by statin drugs.
I don't agree with that. Go ahead.
Well, you're wrong.
You're wrong. You're not based on science. Go ahead. What's your next thing?
Yes, I am. Actually.
No, I don't think so. There's good science.
1 in 450 are affected negatively, severely by statin drugs.
I don't agree with that.
Statin drugs affect. Yeah. It attacks your muscles
Let me answer that.
So the arguments against statin drugs.
So one thing is, there is muscle weakness that comes with statins. That's one of the known side effects. And if one statin doesn't work, another causes the weakness. Another statin may not cause the weakness.
How many statins are there?
I think there are five or six statins. Oh. But they all have their slightly different properties, and they have a slightly different way that the body takes care of the statin, sort of releases
that. So when
that.
Paul mentions like 1 in 250, one of that could be a muscle weakness.
Oh, yes. And it's actually more than that. It's probably like 5 or 10% get muscle weakness.
And often changing
the dosing.
Yeah.
Like if you're on 40 milligrams of Lipitor going to 10 milligrams of Lipitor, that doesn't work going to 5 milligrams of Lipitor or doing it every other day. So there's very good data that shows every other day statins also are very effective. So there are different ways that you can take care of the muscle weakness. And then there still is a group with muscle weakness. It's not wasting. When you stop the statin, the muscle comes back. But there still is a group that's affected and they can't take statins. That's what it is. There's also some other effects. There's an increase in diabetes, the risk of diabetes, which is definitely known to be there. And so what you have to do is see how risky you are. You follow something called the hemoglobin A1C to measure whether or not you have it or developing it. You may have pre-diabetes. And then if you're on a statin, you then have your blood sugar and you see whether or not that is affected by statins. But that's a real, you know, that's a real side effect. And those are probably the two most common side effects. And if you want to look at it, the best place to look is at scientific places. If you want to look at non-scientific places, you'll get non-scientific information.
But Paul, your point is well taken that there are side effects. And there is a bigger picture here that pharmaceuticals don't solve a medical problem. They are part of a treatment.
Correct.
And you've got to have a doctor.
Right.
You have
That's
to
right.
gauge how That's these right. drugs are impacting your body. And we've talked a lot about individualized medicine. Everybody's body is different and they react in different ways. So when you take a new drug or you start a new regimen, you have to figure out how your body reacts to it. And you have to have a professional by your side to help you redirect it, fix the dosage. That this can't happen. It never happens with a pill alone. I think that is a safe assumption.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You have to make lifestyle changes. Stop smoking. Don't drink as much. Exercise more. Get to your weight. Eat a more Mediterranean diet. There are a whole bunch of things that you can do to reduce it. And then are people just put on statins without giving information about the other things? Well, they may get 2 minutes of information, but the real issue is you have to encourage lifestyle improvement to reduce that risk. But since we started treating hypertension, which is in the 70s when I went to medical school, and since we started using statins, and since we stopped smoking, you know, we're down to like 14%, and since we have a better lifestyle, all of those things have reduced heart attacks and strokes by 78-79%.
It really is a big change. It used to be that there was a lot of stroke and heart attacks, and now you're kind of shocked when you're...
They're still there, but they're much less. Per capita, they're much less. And when I started, there were stroke wards in every hospital.
Yeah.
And that's because of the treatment of hypertension, and statins are the other treatment that helps.
If you would like more with our friend Dr. Zorba Pastor, make sure you check out his podcast, Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor, online with drzorba.org, and I invite you back here anytime.
Thank you.
It is a pleasure to be with you. Always. And by the way, you are my parents' favorite too. So it's not just everybody else. Thank you for calling in today. Sorry we didn't get to all the calls or emails, and thank you for being a part of the show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News.